Today on Talk of Iowa, the return of the big white birds. I'm Charity Nebbe. Trumpeter swans weren't seen in Iowa for nearly 100 years when the DNR hatched a plan to reintroduce them in 1993. Still not a very common sight, trumpeter swans have made an impressive and noisy comeback in the state. White pelicans migrate through Iowa, but for many years, it was very unusual to see one. Now, white pelicans are a common sight on the state's rivers and lakes. Wildlife consultant Jim Pease is here for his monthly conversation. Today, we're going to talk about these big white birds and their very different paths to recovery. We'll also be taking your calls at 866-780-9100, and you can send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. The tale of the big white birds after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me today is wildlife consultant Jim Pease here for his monthly program. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm so excited to be on the air with you again. Such a pleasure.
Some of our longtime listeners may not realize this, but you hosted this program, what, 10 or 11 years ago?
Yep, 10 years ago, yeah. Briefly.
Yeah.
for about a year, but we had a lot of fun back then.
We did. It was great fun. I would bring specimens into the studio and try to fool you with what they were freak you out. But it never was able to successfully freak you out. You were always you're really wildlife oriented, really outdoor oriented.
That's true. It's hard to get under my skin. Ticks will push me over the edge. You never brought any ticks in yet.
And not yet. And actually, mosquitoes and ticks. Donald Lewis and I have always had this agreement: if it has more than four legs, that's his territory. And under four legs, or four legs and under, are my territory.
Right. So if we're going to talk about ticks, we'll do it on a Friday. I'll try to put that show off for as long as possible. But Jim, you and a lot of other people in the wildlife business get a lot of questions about big white birds. People say, I was out and I saw these big white birds. What could they be?
That's exactly right. And they kind of wonder. And I say, well, you know, tell me something about their behavior, because you can tell what they are by their behavior and a little bit of observation from a distance. You can tell by their flight patterns, by their behavior on the water, just exactly what they are. And basically, there are not two, but actually three different white birds. One of them we talked about last month on this program when I talked about Am I Heron You Right? it's one of the herons. It's the great egret. That certainly is one possibility. But the other two possibilities that I really want to concentrate on today are the trumpeter swans and white pelicans, both of which are now reasonably common across the state. And certainly if you're around wetlands, you're very likely to see one or both of them.
Right. Well, and certainly they were birds that were not seen 15 years ago.
Yeah, it is amazing. When I think about, you know, it is amazing when you think back to, like you say, 15, even 20 years ago, or certainly when I was growing up, which is a lot longer ago than that, you didn't see these birds at all. And the pace of recovery has sort of picked up, and that's a very exciting thing. You couldn't have convinced me 15 years ago that we would ever have trumpeter swans nesting in great numbers in Iowa, that we would have bald eagles back in Iowa, that we would have white pelicans nesting in Iowa. I just wouldn't have believed it.
You mentioned all three of those birds, and I can remember distinctly the first time I saw each of those species because it was so rare and so cool. But
yeah.
Let's talk about trumpeter swans. And, of course, the first time I saw trumpeter swans was on the Iowa State University campus, because the Lake Laverne there tried to participate in the trumpeter swan reintroduction program, but they had been gone from Iowa for 100 years.
Yes, yeah, at least 100 years. They have this sort of amazing history. If you think back to the mid to late 1800s, wildlife had a very different value to people at those times than it did to folks today, I think. And those values were reflected in the laws that were there, in the way that people exploited the populations. There were no seasons. There were hunting seasons. There were no limits on what they could take, especially with birds. It just was amazing. And in the latter half of the 19th century, the late 1800s up to in the early 1900s, the federal government had absolutely no role in protecting those species, even though they were migratory. And it wasn't until in 1901, and an Iowan by the name of Colonel John Lacey, you've heard of, I think our listeners have heard of Lacey Keosauqua Park. It was named after in his honor. He was in Congress, and he put a bill together that essentially established federal, and it had been challenged many times, but established federal jurisdiction over migratory species. They said that species that are within a state, things like pheasants and quail and grouse and like that don't migrate, are the state's prerogative. But anything that migrates across borders, be they state borders or international borders between Canada and Mexico or Central American countries, that sort of thing, is federal jurisdiction. And that sort of helped for a while, but didn't help a lot until the 1930s when another Iowan by the name of Ding Darling went to Washington. Iowans have figured in this a lot. You know? It's really pretty amazing conservation history. And when Ding Darling went to Washington to head up what became the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, at that time it was called the Biological Survey, he actually sent out federal marshals to enforce some of the laws that had been on the books for a generation already. And until that time, the laws were there, but they really weren't enforced very much. Occasionally, states would enforce them, but not very much.
So trumpeter swans had been hunted to extinction in Iowa. They were not extinct, but they were gone from the state.
They were gone from the state, and most states, they were gone. In fact, they got down by 1900. There were 69 birds left.
Wow. 69 individuals, not pairs.
Right. No, not pairs, but individuals. And they were in a park sort of west of Yellowstone. And it's because it was so isolated that they survived. Just like the story of the bison, you know, the bison survived basically because they were so isolated. and the trumpeter swans did the same thing. So they really, they would have had a tough time coming back from 69 birds without a lot of help.
Well, and that help in Iowa came in the early 1990s when the Department of Natural Resources came up with a plan to reintroduce them. Tell me a little bit about the program.
Yeah, well, the numbers were simply too low for trumpeter swans to make a comeback on their own, and so at least in our lifetimes, and so they needed some special help. And in 1995. The DNR, with the help of hundreds of Iowans, began releasing incubator hatched swans into designated wetlands around the state. And these were, and I say hundreds of Iowans because there were school kids that raised money. There were people that donated money outright. There were lots of folks that participated in feeding them, in protecting those wetlands. Many of the wetlands were not public land, but were on private land because they wanted to make sure that they, and the whole idea was to have them there long enough so that they would develop what's called site tenacity, and in fact it worked very, very well. And now we have not every bird develops that homing instinct to go back to that same wetland. And in fact, some tend to wander. They say, well, this is a nice one, but I think there's a better one over there, you know, and they'll wander away and they've nested in other places. The goal was to have 15 free-flying nesting trumpeter swan pairs by 2003, so that would have been less than 10 years. And that goal was reached in 2004. They did get over 15 that year, but by 2009 there were at least 40 nesting pairs in Iowa wetlands. And I checked yesterday, the count has not come in yet, but there are at least that many, probably more. And these things sort of grow in by leaps and bounds. Once a pair gets established, it certainly releases other birds in the area. And it takes 3 to 4 years before the young mature to adult size and breeding behavior. And they but they do tend to stick around in the same area. However, Iowa released swans have now nested in Missouri and Illinois, helping repopulate those states. I think in Missouri it was the first in 140 years, and in Illinois had been the first nesting swans in 170 years. So the swans that have been released in Iowa have been really important for repopulating other states in the Midwest besides Iowa. And we now have over 5,000 swans, not all of them nesting, but 5,000 swans in the upper Midwest.
What do you think the population should be? What kind of population can we support?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question because there are two kinds of important values here. One is a sort of the ecological tolerance. You know, do we have the wetlands of a proper size? They have to be big enough so that these birds can take off. They have to run across the water, you know, to take off and take flight. They have to be protected enough. Swans nest on mounds, and often in the middle or on the edges of these wetlands. And these mounds are usually made by muskrats or beaver or occasionally, and they'll add to that with some other vegetation in that. And these nests can be, you know, 4 or 5 feet across sometimes. these are very large things. So they like to be surrounded by water. And the birds are pretty particular. A large lake, for example, with coves at each end that support muskrat houses on each end, you might get two pairs on that single lake. But most of our wetlands are not large enough to support that because the birds are very territorial. And so one pair per wetland. So you'd have to do an analysis of the sort of ecological analysis to see if it would support many, many more pairs. And I think we're a long way from the ecological tolerance, but there's also the social tolerance. These birds are large birds, and as I think with most things, as they get more and more common, we will come into probably have some problems. I don't think because they tend not to be grazers like Canada geese are, we won't have the problems that we have with Canada geese on golf courses and things like that. But there's a certain social tolerance that we'll have to deal with.
Well, we'll talk more about their life cycle and their temperament in a moment. You're listening to Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. My guest today is wildlife consultant Jim Pease.
That poor little ugly duckling went wandering far and near. But at every place they said to his face, now, get out of here. Get out. Get out.
It's Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me today is wildlife consultant Jim Pease, and we're talking about big white birds in the state of Iowa. Specifically, we've been talking about the trumpeter swan, and Jim, we were just listening to The Ugly Duckling there.
Yes, so, by Danny Kaye, yeah. Wasn't it?
Yep, that's right, that's right. So let's talk about their ugly ducklings. Let's talk about the cygnets. How many cygnets do they produce?
Well,
in a given year,
they will lay between 5 and 10 eggs, and if they're fortunate, they'll produce, you know, depending on the food supply and everything, they'll produce after an incubation period of about a month, a little more than that. These huge eggs, and they're 4.5 inches to 5 inches long. You know, these are big eggs. They will produce 3 or 4 young ones if they're fortunate. Sometimes a few more, but usually 3 or 4 is about what they can support. And within 24 hours, these little guys, they're covered with this down, and they're actually pretty cute compared to a lot of other.
Yeah, I wouldn't call them ugly.
No, not at all. They're not as beautiful and graceful as their parents, but they are within 24 hours out of the nest, swimming and feeding on their own. It's amazing. The parents will help them feed because they need large amounts of protein to grow quickly. And so for the first month or so, their diet is almost exclusively aquatic invertebrates, those little bugs that you see in the water, everything from Daphnia up through dragonfly nymphs and damselfly nymphs, they'll feed on those because insects have a very high a percentage of protein. Some insects can exceed 80 to 90% protein. So it's a really good source of food for young birds. And the cygnets will feed very heavily on those for the first month or so. And then they'll switch over to what their parents eat. And it's that switchover that is often difficult. Their parents are primarily vegetarians. They eat aquatic plants and tubers. They'll switch over. Then the young ones have to switch over to that. And depending, again, here's one of those ecological sort of limiters, is that depending on the depth of the lake, they may have difficulty reaching them because they don't dive. They feed from the surface, and in fact, it's quite comical. Some of our listeners can actually watch for this behavior to see adults in deeper water doing what it's because they're dabbling, just like dabbling ducks. These adult trumpeter swans with their rear ends, big white rear ends, straight up in the air because they're taking those long necks and eating the vegetation off the bottom of that wetland. So you'll see them with their rear ends up in the air, tipping up, and they're using their feet to keep them under, their heads down underwater, and they're eating plants in the bottom. And so depending on the wetland, that switchover can be either easy for the young ones or more difficult.
So you mentioned that the young don't mature to nesting age for 2 or 3 years.
Right, 3 or 4 years.
Or three or four years, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it takes them a while to mate. Do they mate for life?
Well, that's a good question. They certainly have very long-term relationships.
Maybe they're serial monogamous?
They are pretty monogamous, it appears. As with most things, as we do more and more DNA studies, we find out in the bird world there's a whole lot more messing around out there than we think about. But because the pair is so territorial and they have such a strong site tenacity, they come back there year after year after year, they are pretty much very, very loyal to their mate. Now, there have been instances where if a mate is killed, sometimes they will find another mate and sometimes they don't. The mating is actually the pair bond is formed actually in the off season before they get to the breeding grounds. By the time they get to the breeding grounds, they've paired off and they are very, very strongly tenacious to their mate and to that site. But for the most part, yeah, I'd say they mate for life for as long as they can.
How long do they live?
They have been known to live in excess of 30 years. Certainly in captivity, they can live longer than that. 34, 35, I think, is the maximum. But usually you're talking, particularly with a bird with fairly low reproductive rates, you know, 3 or 4 young a year, or and fewer survive. Then, if they bring off a young or two that makes it to adulthood, that's pretty good. And so these low reproductive rates are usually equated with long lifespans. And so 18 to 20 years is really nothing for a swan, and longevity up to about 30 years. So yeah, they do pretty well.
If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 866-780-9100. Maybe you've had some close encounters with trumpeter swans, and we'll be talking about pelicans in just a few minutes. So if you want to talk about some pelican sightings or if you have questions for Jim Pease, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jim, before we move on to pelicans, I want to talk about trumpeter swans temperaments, because I mentioned earlier there was an unsuccessful attempt to introduce trumpeter swans on Lake Laverne at Iowa State University. It was not successful, largely because they didn't produce any young, but also they did not seem particularly happy there.
No, they weren't. I mentioned how some birds will be site tenacious, and they put them in these wetlands hoping that they'll develop a sort of an affinity to that site. And what happened on the Lake Laverne, for those who don't know, is a small lake area.
Or a large pond.
Yeah, large pond in front of the Student Union, and between right on Lincoln Way on one side and the campus on the other. And the birds tended to wander. They would wander up into the central campus. They would develop their territory. They were expanding their territory by attacking students, you might say.
Well, I do remember one incident where the male actually got on top of a car and pulled the windshield wipers off.
Yeah, and we still have no idea why that happened. But was he mad at the car? Did he like the rubber flavoring? We're not sure. Yeah, they just simply were not set for an urban environment. Unlike Canada geese that have adapted very well to urban areas, I don't think, and we'll see down the road, but I don't think trumpeter swans will ever be good urban birds.
And they were in captivity, basically, and
yes,
especially after some of the attacks occurred, they were put behind a fence. So that probably made them more temperamental.
Didn't like that at all. But what they've done instead is they now substituted mute swans, which are a much more a bird that's better adapted to the urban environment. They tend to stay where they're put and don't have the sort of territorial instincts that trumpeters do.
So when the trumpeters were there, I learned not to walk my dog along Lake Laverne because she was very frightened of a bird with a 6-foot wingspan saying nasty things to her.
Yeah, you
really
bet.
Rude things.
Yeah, very, very rude. They can have their bodies, if you measure them from the tip of their beak to the tip of their tail, they're 5 to 6 feet long. They have this 7 to in large males that can have nearly 10-foot wingspan, and they weigh 25 to 35 pounds. This is a big bird. It tells you something though when you're talking about the dog. How do these birds survive predators? And the answer is very, very well. Yes, the cygnets are often taken by everything from very large northern pike, snapping turtles, bobcats, coyotes, even some foxes. Occasionally, eggs might be preyed on at an unprotected nest by raccoons or skunks. But these are tough birds, and they're very, very protective of their young and of their nest sites.
Well, and they're physically imposing, but they're also really loud. And here's a sample of a trumpeter swan, not an angry trumpeter swan, just a normal one.
Right.
So they come by their names, honestly.
Yeah, the trumpet is they'll use that trumpet during breeding, and as you say, it's sort of an alarm signal as well, and we'll let a predator know, hey, I'm a big white bird, look out for me.
Well, we are going to be taking your calls about swans and about other big white birds coming up in about 5 minutes. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're talking to wildlife consultant Jim Pease today. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm here today with wildlife consultant Jim Pease, and we are talking about big white birds. We've been talking about trumpeter swans so far this hour. We're going to move on to pelicans in a moment. But, Jim, we have a couple more questions about swans. One caller who couldn't stay on the line wants to know what the most common kind of swan is in Iowa.
in the summer, it's certainly the trumpeter swan. We do have what are called tundra swans, which look very similar but are quite a bit smaller, that we will see on migration. Being tundra, the name tundra swan, they obviously nest much farther north than here, but they do come through here in the fall. It's difficult, I think, for a lot of people to tell them apart. The tundra swans, by size, are really quite a bit smaller, and they have, instead of this black face and beak and black feet that the trumpeters have, they have a black face with a little bit of yellow above the beak, and you have to look for that. I think it's
hard
very
to
difficult.
See when they're flying.
Yeah, it is. So, but you can see if they're all white and flying often, and you'll see these big V's of tundra swans. It's easy to tell that it's at least a swan, and it's either a tundra or a trumpeter.
Are there mute swans living in the wild?
There are some, but they're not commonly. Mostly, they have. You know, they're more escapes from captivity, but there are some.
And of course, we've seen mute swans on, mm-hmm. on a lot of ponds over the years. They are a species that can live in the wild. Is it a wild species, or are they
yes.
mainly?
Yes, yeah, okay. They're just not native to here, and they have orangish bills and this sort of orange on their head. So they're very different looking than either tundras or trumpeters.
Denise is on the line from Atlantic. Hello, Denise.
Good morning, and thank you for having this program. I feel very privileged in that in Atlantic we have a rock quarry where we have visitors of the trumpeter swans and their families, and they've been returning for years and years. And
great.
Our conservation board has every between Christmas and New Year's, we have a soiree with the swans, and we have an outdoor cookout, and we have Ron Andrews, who is now retired, but he's been here for years coming down, and so they don't nest here, but they return here, and
that's
the naturalist
great.
In the county has kept track of the families when they were banded, and I helped one year band them, and I got to hold one, and I it was just the most incredible experience, and I loved doing that. So I'm really appreciative of trumpeter swans.
Sure. Now you got to hold them. This is a big
yes.
bird, huh?
It's a big bird, and I loved it because, and of course, it was in the cold, so I was real well dressed. And what I really loved about it is that the long neck kind of wrapped around my head and up, and I've got a picture of it, and I think that's a picture that not many people can say they have in their collection.
That's for sure.
But I do have a question actually about dragonflies. If I can just switch over to that for just a brief
moment. I'll try.
Okay. The other night at my farm, and we were out working and, of course, batting mosquitoes everywhere mm-hmm. and because mm-hmm. of the type of year it is. But we looked over, and this was about 7 o'clock at night. It was getting, you know, a little bit cooler than that. And we all of a sudden saw, like, hundreds and hundreds of dragonflies. And they were in one part of the farm, and then they were in different parts, and we saw them. And I remember when I went in that night, I was actually pretty mosquito-free. I didn't get bit, mm-hmm. and I'm a magnet for mosquitoes. So as dragonflies, is that one of the things that they do eat? Would they have been on a rampage, you know, cleaning up all the mosquitoes for that night?
That's exactly what they were doing. Dragonflies, it's been a very good year for dragonflies as well because of a lot of wetlands. The nymph form, the juvenile form of dragonflies, are aquatic. They're one of the aquatic insects that trumpeter swans will eat in these ponds. But when they become adults and they crawl out and they develop those great big wings, they are some of the best flying predators we have on mosquitoes and other insects as well, but especially mosquitoes. And they fly around, and you're absolutely right. At dusk, you'll see them by the hundreds sometimes, zipping in and out. I was on a canoe trip in Maine this summer with my grandkids, and one night we were sitting there by the fire, and sure enough, the dragonflies were there by the hundreds, and we're just cleaning the mosquitoes out of the air. It was a really wonderful experience.
Denise, thank you so much for your call. And you can join our conversation by calling 866-780-9100. Jacob in Odison has another swan question. He heard us talking about mute swans. And last winter and this year, the Iowa Ornithology Union first confirmed the presence of free-flying mute swans within Iowa borders. Mm-hmm. And he wants to know if you can comment on this because he's concerned about this exotic species coming from Europe, which has been destructive invaders in the Great Lakes region where they destroy habitat. They also... I mean, they fight off native birds as well, don't they?
Yeah, they'll take up habitat. And it's a controversy, certainly within not just within the bird community, but some scientists believe that, in fact, they do take up space, like many invasive species do. They take up space where native species should be. That's up in the air still. I don't think we know yet whether... they will be aggressive enough to prevent. We simply don't have enough trumpeters in the wild yet, I think, to know, even though we've released over 1,000 of them in the state of Iowa. I don't think we know that if there are enough competition where that the trumpeters will be able to withstand the mute swan competition.
Trumpeters are bigger.
Yes, quite a lot bigger.
All right, so that may give them a little bit of an edge.
Right, and they have that great trumpet sound.
That's true. It's very intimidating.
Absolutely.
I have one last question about trumpeter swans, which is where do they go when they leave for the winter?
Well, they it used to be that they just overwintered in one place. Certainly, we do have, and people will see them. The young swans have been given special overwintering areas here in the state. That are open and like that, but they do fly south to Texas sort of the Gulf Coast area, but they still like large lakes and that in the area.
Well, I hear you mentioned the Gulf Coast, and of course a lot of our white pelicans go to the Gulf Coast as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a concern given the oil spill that their fish may be contaminated?
It's certainly...
I mean, obviously, pelicans eat fish. The trumpeter swans do not.
Trumpeter swans don't. But it is certainly a concern as we talk about oil spills, and we had one in Kalamazoo, Michigan, as well. You know, on the Kalamazoo River, oil is a concern for any wildlife species, and particularly aquatic wildlife. These birds are certainly under threat. So, as not only are they threatened by the future loss of wetlands, various technologies, oil spills, other threats certainly remain. But I think it's one of the things we have to be concerned about. But so far, they've shown their great resiliency, I think.
Well, let's talk about pelicans. As I mentioned earlier, I think I was probably 18 years old before I saw a white pelican in Iowa and was totally stunned by the sight. I thought that it had wandered off of its pathway. I thought it was lost. But where were white pelicans for all those years?
They were primarily a western species, Rocky Mountains. And if you look at breeding bird survey maps still, they just show Iowa, anything east of the western edge of Iowa, sort of out of the range of white pelicans. But of course... they've been coming here for a long time, and it's only been recently, we think, that they've actually been nesting here again. They nested when I was doing research up in northern Alberta. I would commonly see them on the large lakes up there. They would nest up to the northern part of Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, in all the lake complexes up there. These are unlike the trumpeter swans. These are colonial nesting birds. These are another large white bird, but they tend not to be solitary. And in fact, there's some evidence that when they nest in colonies like that, the presence of the colony tends to sort of synchronize their nesting efforts so that they all kind of the young will hatch at about the same time. These birds are large and big and white, but they have black primary feathers and the outermost secondary feathers. Those they're two different kinds of flight feathers. So when they're in flight, you can see that black on their wings. Usually, when they're sitting on the water, most of that black is covered up, and it's hard to see that. But you can see this large black area on their primaries and their outer secondaries when they're in flight, and they fly fly totally different than the swans do. The swans tend to flap constantly, although it's a slow, graceful flapping. Pelicans are a little bit smaller and certainly much lighter. They only weigh 10 to 15 pounds and for the most part, and they may be 4 to 5 feet long, including their bill, which is quite large. And but you'll see them in groups in the air, and they will flap and then glide for long periods of time. They take advantage of the thermal air currents that rise over a lake area, and they can glide for a long, long ways.
So would pelicans have been common at one time in Iowa and then disappeared, or are they expanding their range?
I think some of both. If you look at some of the early records from the 1800s here and early 1900s, they were certainly not only here, but they nested here early on, but disappeared very, very quickly. I think that they were like many birds, like we told the tale earlier of swans. They were exploited not only for meat, but also for their feathers. In the late 1800s, there was an incredible industry built up around especially women's hats. The haberdashery business employed one of every 1,000 Iowans or Americans, and some 83,000 Americans were employed in the women's hat industry. And women's hats at that time were usually populated with large numbers of birds, including songbirds and pelicans, and especially egrets' feathers. And as I mentioned earlier, there were no laws at the time, so these birds were often taken right out of their nests, right in. And being a colonial bird, they were easy to wipe out. White pelicans nest on the ground. They're not up in trees. So it's very easy to exploit this bird. And so they really disappeared from the state for a long, long time. And they were never common in other, we think, than anything other than some of the northwestern part of the state where we have large lakes, because they are really a bird of large lakes.
Chris is on the line in Davenport. Hello, Chris.
Hi there.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, yeah, I think it's great what you're talking about. And a few years ago, I went on a canoe trip with some friends of mine down to Des Moines. Mm-hmm. And we canoed from Lake Sailorville Lake to Lake Red Rock, and saw some great birds, some herons, and then a number of pelicans. Mm-hmm. Especially when we got to the entrance of Lake Red Rock, it was amazing because there was hundreds of them mm-hmm. blocking our entrance into the lake. And it just intrigued me because you were talking about swans earlier and how they can be very aggressive towards humans, and the pelicans really could care less as to our existence.
Right.
We had to almost canoe right into them before they'd move, which is kind of scary on our part.
Yeah, they're very different. They're a very gregarious bird, and they're not. These were primarily young non-breeding birds, and I was going to say before we took your call there that one of the differences is that as we have, it used to be the big lakes in Iowa were in northwestern Iowa, the Okoboji region, but now we have these large reservoirs, including reservoirs that are formed along the Mississippi River, essentially large lakes, and the birds have responded to that. So Charity's question about whether they have expanded their range or simply reoccupied, I think they're doing both. They're reoccupying, but there are other things that are now available for them, these large reservoir systems, and Red Rock and Sailorville are both quite common to see white pelicans actually throughout the ice-free part of the year. They'll be there, and they're primarily non-breeding young ones, and you're right, you're floating into them. You have to think about this. You're floating into them in a canoe. Essentially, you're just a big, ugly, green or brown pelican. They don't perceive you as a threat at all, and they're looking at you, going, "Geez, it's a big bird, but holy mackerel, is it ugly?" You know, it doesn't perceive much of a threat at all. So, yeah.
In retrospect, I appreciate that they didn't perceive us.
I think you're right. Now, did you watch some feeding at all?
You know, we didn't. It was a really choppy day. We were making really good headway until we got to Lake Red Rock. We had winds headwinds coming at us, and we were just worried about getting to shore.
Sure, yeah. But, they're pretty amazing to watch them feed. Unlike the tipping up of the trumpeter swans feeding on vegetation, these guys are almost exclusively fish eaters. And they'll be in that shallow water, particularly at the upper end of the lakes, feeding on fish on the surface. They'll often feed alone, but the really neat thing is to watch them do cooperative fishing. And there'll be half a dozen or 10 or 12 of them. I've seen this before, where they'll sort of surround an area and swim forward, kind of herding fish into the shallows, and then they'll surround them and all get to eat then. They simply dip their bill in the water, and this big bag underneath can hold like 3 gallons of water, and so they strain out the water and keep the fish. So the cooperative nature of their fishing is really interesting to watch.
Chris, thank you so much for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 866-780-9100. You can tweet IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org.
It's appropriate that they tweet talking about birds.
That's true.
Sorry.
You couldn't resist.
I couldn't.
The colonial nature of their nesting and the fact that they nest on the ground seems like it would make them very vulnerable. Are there predators that take advantage of that other than humans?
Yeah, there certainly are, and that's why they, I think, in the past have been mainly restricted to islands in large lakes, because the islands are somewhat better protected from predators than being on the shoreline. And in fact, I think the colony that is nesting now just in the Mississippi River east of Clinton is actually on an island as well. And while it's not perfect protection, it certainly reduces the possibility of things like raccoons and possums and skunks and foxes that would come in and take eggs or young. The young are very, very vulnerable once they're hatched, because while they don't make a lot of sound, they do make these sort of, I'd call it sort of a sneezing sound, which is a food cry saying, "Here I am, feed me. And that makes them certainly vulnerable. Because the birds are not as big and powerful and as trumpeter swans are, there is a certain safety in numbers. And so if you're in the colony and you're in the center of that colony, you probably are better protected than if you're on the outside of that colony. So there's sort of this pecking order within the colony for the best space. But, yeah, there are certainly predators that are much better able to get to the young and the eggs than they would for trumpeter swans.
We talked about swans at least being serial monogamous, if not lifetime mates. How about pelicans?
No. There certainly seems to be a strong pair bond. Both parents participate during the breeding season, but they are not monogamous for long, many years of time that we see in swans.
How many young would they have each year?
Usually they'll lay just 1 to 3 eggs, and a couple may hatch. But usually by the time those young fledge, and they're a long time at birth, at hatching, they are naked, unlike the and really totally dependent on the parents.
So much more like a songbird.
Yeah, exactly. And once they by the time a month or 6 weeks later that they get to fledging, there's usually only one left. There's a lot of the oldest, most aggressive one is usually the one that survives.
And do they bring them fish in the nest?
Yes, yeah. And this is great. They make their own baby food, and they do that by eating the fish and then regurgitating it back to the young. And again, it's high protein, very high protein. And once they fledge, then they go out with the parents and learn to fish with them and on their own.
So do they store that regurgitation in their pouch? Do the babies have to stick their heads in their parents' mouths?
Yeah, they do. But the parents have taken it farther down in order to make in the consistency, and then they regurgitate it into the pouch, and the babies stick their beak right in the pouch and eat it out.
How long does it take a pelican to mature?
Again, it's 2 to 3 years, and because they are a long-lived bird, they tend to, take several years to get to the point where they're able to survive adulthood. So it's that period that they're most vulnerable. But those are mostly the birds that we're seeing here in central Iowa and other places around the country, around the state, because they are they're collections of non-breeding birds that we're seeing in some of the lakes and rivers around here.
How long do they spend in Iowa?
Well, they'll leave in sort of mid fall, September, October time period, and you'll see them during migration, and then overwinter in the Gulf Coast, all the way down into large lakes, including into Central America like Nicaragua.
Do you know of any projects to study the effect that the oil spill may have on them as they return to Iowa next year?
No, I don't. And certainly there's a concern. Hopefully the oil will be cleaned up enough where they will not be ingesting that or collecting it on their feathers. They're very different than the brown pelicans that we've seen in so many of the news reports from the Gulf, because brown pelicans actually dive under the water, whereas these guys just feed on the surface. And brown pelicans are therefore much more susceptible to getting covered with oil that is just below the surface than white pelicans are.
All right, Jim, thank you so much.
My pleasure. It's been real interesting to see the difference in how these two species have recovered. Pelicans coming back on their own, and trumpeter swans really needing a lot of our help.
Well, and hopefully we'll see a lot more of both species in the future. Thank you. Jim Pease, wildlife consultant, joins us once a month on the second Tuesday of each month to talk about wildlife in Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Rosalind Sixby, and it is Rosalind's last day today after nearly 2 years at Iowa Public Radio. Thank you so much, Rosalind, and good luck with your next step. Technical support today from Michael Yeager in Ames. We always welcome your comments. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, the gay wedding industry in Iowa. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.